If everyone wants to go ahead, oh, that was louder than I thought. Find your seats. We'll go ahead and get started with the Q&A time here as everybody's wrapping up. Just a couple announcements of upcoming events here at the Science Center. There is no Cafe Sci in July, so please don't come in July for Cafe Sci, because you'll be the only one. We're taking July off because of the holiday. So no Cafe Sci in July. We'll pick back up in August. So our next Cafe Sci will be August 4th. Our speaker is Craig Nelson, who wrote a book called The Age of Radiance. He'll be speaking about the forgotten women of the atomic era. So August 4th is the next Cafe Sci. After that, we have a Cafe Sci on September 1st. It's kind of crazy to think we're talking about September already. But August 4th, then September 1st, we have Catherine Fries, who is talking about dark matter. So that should be an interesting lecture as well. And our next 21 Plus Night is coming up on June 13th. The theme is beer, so we're exploring the science of beer at our next 21 Plus Night. This one's a little bit different than others we've done. Tickets are $17 and include 10 samples from 5 different local breweries. We actually get to sample different breweries from the region. And everybody who comes to do the sampling gets a sampler glass, souvenir sampler glass. So that's a little bit of a special thing for this upcoming 21 Plus Night. And, of course, everybody who comes gets $15 in a free slot play at the casino, so the night could pay for itself, which is always fun. I think that's it for my event announcements. A little bit of how our Q&A will work. Ashley is in the center aisle with our microphone. We'll keep the microphone right there where Ashley is. If you have a question, we can form a line at the microphone. You can ask your question, get your answer. Remember, we are recording everything for the podcast, so please make sure you speak into the microphone, speak nice and loudly, so everybody can hear, everybody can hear your question, and it should be good. So if anybody has some questions, we can head up to Ashley at the microphone. If you absolutely cannot get to the microphone, you can wave Ashley down, and she can bring it to you if we have to, but we'll try to keep it easy and keep everybody up at the microphone. So I'll turn it back over to Dr. Barth.
What advances have been made lately in the preservation of memory for people like me who are getting old?
So, you know, there are some compounds that are quite promising in terms of enhancing memory called ampakines, and they work by enhancing normal communication between neurons, normal synaptic transmission. I don't know if they're clinically available, although I know that they're in trials. And I think that if it were me, I think I would be concerned about what the long-term effects of those treatments would be. So one thing that we know about the nervous system, not only do the connections between our neurons change with our experience, but when we alter our experience, the milieu of our brain, for example, by taking certain drugs like Xanax, for example, right, benzodiazepines, that the brain starts to compensate for that. And that after some time, you're now no longer at the state that you were. And in fact, if you stop taking a drug, you're almost in more trouble than you were before. And so I would say that some of the treatments that you might be able to take, I think that their long-term use can be problematic. Now, I'm not a physician. I don't run any clinical trials, so I couldn't say that for sure. But I will say that I think a more promising area for me is how we can use behavioral manipulations, perhaps with some pharmacological manipulations, how we can leverage our understanding of memory to then use, for example, spaced training, timing of when you're presented with some stimulus in order to facilitate this. One of the best ways, and I tell my students this all the time, one of the best ways to consolidate memory is to sleep. Learn something and go to sleep. And that repeated training with intermittent sleep seems to be extremely effective in enhancing memory. I think for older people, as sleep becomes more disrupted, it may also have some consequence with memory. But, you know, there's a lot of different studies. Some of my friends and colleagues were asking me about red wine. And I know that for many of you, that would be a big draw. You could say that red wine is really necessary for to enhance your memory. So.
And a corollary question. I have read that doing puzzles and doing other challenges, things that are, like using your left hand instead of your right will also help to preserve or enhance that function. Do you find a repetitive task or novelty to be more conducive to that?
You know, I think if you're asking my personal opinion, I would say I think novelty, my impression is that novelty is important. But I can't tell you the state of the art in terms of the research for that particular question. My mother's a big fan of lumosity, I think, and she swears by it. But in fact, I think some studies that, you know, are looking at people's performance on some of these tasks. So for example, let's say you're doing a puzzle task, or you're doing a task where you need to identify, you know, that the arrow that's moving in one direction against a field of arrows that are moving in a different direction. Practicing that makes you better at that task, but it may not make you better at a lot of other tasks. So that's sort of with relation to novelty.
Thank you.
Sure.
I've kind of a larger question of how experience and memory can be so different in a sibling, a group of siblings. My father died about 30 years ago. And there are seven of us, and we all have different memories of that experience, which I find fascinating. As we sit, you know, we've sat down and talked about it. And is someone looking at how emotion also defines memory? I mean, that's like the biggest topic of all time. But I think it's fascinating that some of us remember very specific things and others of us don't have no memory of that at all, and that we don't have a similar experience of something that we all went through at the same time. It's just fascinating to me.
So one thing that's very interesting, especially about emotional memory, is that if you take a group of people, for example, who are anxious or depressed, and something negative happens to them, their memory of that and the effect that has on them is much more pronounced than if you take somebody, for example, who is not an anxious person. And some of this appears to be genetic. In fact, probably many of us in the audience have had this experience where, the girls or the women, somebody says something and they're devastated by it. And the guys or the boys, I have a teenage daughter, you know, and she hears something and she's completely gutted by it. And, you know, you take the boy down the street and he's like, yeah, whatever. He doesn't care at all, right? And it's the same comments in the same context, and it just doesn't have the same impact. And it looks as though there are differences, genetic differences between individuals, also perhaps hormonal differences that change the way that memory is encoded.
Thank you for this opportunity. To build on the last question on the impact of negative memory, could you go into a little bit of more detail about the erasure of reactive memory, specifically PTSD or types of negative? You alluded to that a little bit in your paper about experience-dependent plasticity, and kind of stopped there at the end. It was thrown in the conclusion. Could you go into more detail, please?
Yeah, it's really interesting. Actually, in rodents, so I'm going to talk more about rodents because I'm more expert in thinking about these model organisms than thinking about clinical treatment for something like PTSD. Mm-hmm. But you can take a mouse, for example, and put him in a cage that he's never been before, and give him a foot shock, a mild foot shock. And when you put him back into that cage, he'll freeze because he remembers that cage was a site of something uncomfortable. And you can slowly entrain him out of that memory by repeatedly putting him in the cage, and there's never a foot shock, and he slowly starts to move around more and more and become more and more comfortable in that environment. And that process is called extinction. So you're extinguishing the memory. But in fact, if you shock the animal in that cage again, he freezes immediately, and now it'll be much harder for that memory to be extinguished. It looks like the mechanism for extinguishing a fearful memory like that is actually sort of an overriding of the memory. You remember that something bad happened, but you're going to suppress that because it didn't happen every time, and you're going to sort of work past it. But when something bad happens again, you get another speeding ticket at the same intersection, right? And then it's harder to forget. By understanding some of the molecular principles by which synapses are strengthened, and especially in a part of the brain that's really important for fear memories or for emotional memories, we've been able to discern some and understand some principles of how to actually not extinguish those memories, which is sort of override them, but to erase them. And so it turns out, if you do something or use space, you control the timing of that mouse's exposure to that new novel chamber. So you give him a foot shock in the chamber, and the next day you put him in the chamber where there's no foot shock, and then you take him out of the chamber for anywhere between about 10 minutes to about an hour, a little over an hour. So you reactivate the memory, and you wait. And then you take that animal and you put him back in the chamber. And now you can take him out and put him back in multiple times. In that case, it appears that you do something fundamentally different than extinguish or suppress that memory. It appears that you can actually erase that memory. And it appears that the synapses that have been changed during the original encoding of the memory are reactivated when the animal goes back into that chamber, and they're destabilized in some way. And so those synaptic changes then become evaporate. And you can then erase them permanently so that the animal now will no longer fear that chamber. But it's by understanding the timing of these events that enables you to start to manipulate them. And these sorts of approaches are being used to treat people with a post-traumatic stress disorder. So not just reactivation of the memory, but timing the reactivation of the memory in such a way that you can take advantage of these biological principles.
I see. So the implication is to reintroduce, if you're going to go from rodent memory to human memory, okay, to reintroduce someone into a stressful situation but at a lower level, is that kind of the treatment method or procedure?
It seems to have to do with the timing. So I could give you the name of somebody. Kerry Ressler at Emory is a clinician, and he's been very interested in trying to leverage some of these methods that have been learned in rodents to treat clinical disorders.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
It seems like the research in brain function and memory has gone from the electrical level to the chemical level. Now you've introduced the genetic level. Is there any research being done at the physical level? In other words, if something happens, does a dendrite or a group of dendrites grow by 10% or rotate clockwise by 5%?
So, in fact, you're absolutely right. I really skipped over some of the most exciting things that are happening. There's been a revolution in imaging structures in the brain. And you guys, there's a lot of this going on at Carnegie Mellon, and there's a number of great people who could come and talk to you about some of the things that we've been able to do by watching these tiny structures practically at the light diffraction limit, right? Nanometers, hundreds of nanometers, only a few hundred nanometers, watching connections between neurons grow and develop by monitoring neurons but using fluorescence. And so we can monitor both the activity of neurons, the electrical activity, using fluorescence, and we can monitor their anatomy, their physical changes in their physical structure, also using fluorescence. And in fact, one thing that you see, for example, in motor cortex, When you train an animal, so again, I'll talk about animals because, in fact, many of these things, we wouldn't dare do them in a human, right? There's too much risk involved. You would never open up someone's skull and have any risk of infection just to see what a few neurons are doing. Just, you'd never do it. A mouse is a little bit different, right? So we feel like we can identify first what part of the brain we'd like to look at, and we can train the animal in such a way and then look at how neural structure is altered during the training paradigm that's used. So, for example, you can train a mouse. You can put him in a cage where there's some seeds. There's a pile of seeds, and he's hungry. And there's a little opening. And the opening is only on the right side. And he can't get in that opening with his left paw. But he can reach in and grab a seed with his right paw. And he has to learn how to do it. When he starts to do it, he fails all the time. He drops the seed. But he learns how to do it, and then he gets to eat the seed. And if you watch motor cortex, the part of the brain that's required for generating motor commands, if you watch neurons in motor cortex, you can see their structure change. You can see tiny little connections growing on neurons in that part of the brain. It's not all of them. If you're watching 100 dendrites, if you're watching 100 synapses, you might only see a couple be added. But you can see them, they weren't there before, then they're added as the animal learns this task. And then you can see that they're stable over time. And as the animal continues to do the task, those connections remain. There's a revolution in imaging. It's extraordinary the kinds of detail, the kinds of things that we can see. We're still trying to connect the anatomical changes to the electrical changes and to the molecules that we know are involved. But all these different questions are sort of proceeding together. They haven't quite been integrated yet, but we're just at the time when we're going to be able to do that.
Hi. At my age, I've been especially concerned about my own memory. And one of the things I've learned lately is that focusing is extremely an important part. If one practices focusing. I wonder if you could talk about that a little bit, if that's an area of interest.
So one of the things I'm really interested in my own research is what gates plasticity, right? So what's required in order to change synaptic strength, to change synapses, and what's required to maintain those changes in synaptic strength? And it appears that attention is much better, right? If you want to remember somebody's phone number, you can bootstrap yourself into remembering someone's phone number. That's extraordinary, right? You can make your brain do certain things. You're in charge in some way. And one way that it's thought that this sort of process occurs is that attention is associated with the release of a neurochemical called acetylcholine. Acetylcholine is the neurochemical that enables your muscles to contract. But in the brain, in the central nervous system, it appears to change the excitability of neurons. And in fact, it may change the way that plasticity can be initiated. And so one of the things that attention might be doing is reducing the threshold for plastic changes to occur. And so understanding those specific molecular pathways and understanding how different cell types interact to enable attention to modulate plasticity or learning, I think will be a fundamentally interesting question for at least the next few decades.
Could you explain the interplay between the amygdala and the hippocampus with the explicit and implicit memory? Is that too broad?
The interplay between the amygdala and the hippocampus?
Yeah.
Well, so one of the things that I find unsatisfying about the hippocampus, right? I said 50 million neurons, right? And it's got a lot of different inputs, multisensory inputs. And we know it's got a lot of inputs, multisensory inputs. We know it also has a lot of outputs to different areas, including the amygdala. And it's actually hard to figure out where all these different inputs and outputs are going. So there's not a lot of anatomical structure. The amygdala is important for other types of learning that don't necessarily involve the hippocampus. So this fear conditioning, for example, our mouse who remembers that when he was over here in this cage, he got a foot shock. That mouse, the synapses that are changed there are probably in the amygdala. But there is some interplay between the hippocampus and the amygdala. Generally, the amygdala does not appear to be required for episodic or semantic memory, but certain types of memory, such as fear or emotional memories, are incredibly salient. And the other type of memory that I said, you know, I'm totally fascinated by is conditioned taste avoidance. And that seems to be, the amygdala seems to be really important for that. So I don't know if I'm directly answering your question. I think you can dissect apart these two memory systems, but there's a lot of inputs and outputs, and there's a lot of interdependence as well.
While I'm here, I'd like to ask you another one. With the information that you were talking about, what implications does it have for, like, treating PTSD and, you know, other traumatic type experiences? I mean, now that we start to understand the different parts of the brain and how the emotionality comes in, is it given a clearer picture of taking a different route than what we may have been doing at this point?
Well, there have been a lot of treatments for things like PTSD, and many of them haven't worked so well. So, I mean, one of the things I wanted to point out, right, is it's not only that, you know, half of us want to improve our memories and the rest of us just want to forget. And those two, you know, processes are probably, you know, they're different sides of the same coin. I was mentioning with PTSD, understanding something about the timing of the stimulus and the reactivation of those memories may enable us to manipulate them in such a way that we can erase them, not just suppress them, but actually reverse some of those changes. And I think that's some very exciting work that's being done in that area.
Thanks. Hi. I was just wondering, over a period of time, I've heard several different claims one way or another that various foods, things like vitamins or ginkgo biloba, would increase memory capability, and then another person told me, oh, gee, you know, artificial sweeteners destroy it and all that stuff over a long period of time. I was wondering, do you know of any research that has gone on nutritional enhancement type of effects on memory, and if so, what they've discovered?
You know, I don't think I can give you a lot of advice. And I know, you know, from the popular press, you know, people talk about blueberries being really important. Red wine may have some critical things in it. I don't think I could give you a menu of items that would improve your memory. I would say if there was one thing that I wanted to do to improve my memory, I actually think that sleep is really critical. And so, you know, if you feel like your memory is really failing you, I think adjusting the quality of your sleep or the duration of your sleep might be effective. So, about that. I wish there was something that I could take, you know, that I could eat more of.
No problem. I mean, I've just heard these things from different people, yeah. And being in science myself, I sit there and say, well, what's your source of information? What evidence do you have? And all that kind of stuff. But my brain is kind of corroding nicely with age. Thank you.
I have a question regarding more of learning, academic learning. I've read over the years there's different kinds of learners. There's mostly visual, then you have auditory and perhaps kinetic learning. I'm just curious, has there been any research on exactly where this particular, on learning a particular subject, where these different categories of learners would locate on the brain? Do they locate? There's any research on this as to specific locations?
So, you know, I can tell you about some genetic mutations or polymorphisms that are associated with different types of behavior or learning. And some of these are proteins that are at the synapse. So they're really at the right place, and so it's quite plausible that they're involved. Now, I know that there are many different styles of learning, and there are many different, there are people who learn things very effectively through one medium and not another. And in fact, I know people, for example, who are brilliant scientists, but absolutely cannot recognize someone's face for the life of them. They just can't do it. And that indicates that there are different processes, right, and different anatomical areas for these kinds of abilities. And so somebody who's has a prosopagnosia, right, and can't recognize faces, has a deficiency in a particular part of the brain that must be involved, I think, with plasticity, right? Because they can identify the eyes, the nose, the mouth, that it is a person. It's not that they can't see the face. It's just that they don't recognize the face. And so I think there's a lot that we can learn from these different kinds of, this diversity of learning strategies, for example, or people's inability to learn certain things in certain ways. It's been poorly explored in terms of a genetic basis for it. So let me just give you one example. The Nobel Prize this year was awarded to a group for studying basically how synaptic transmission occurs, how synapses communicate with each other. And synapses communicate with each other through the release of a chemical neurotransmitter that fuses with the membrane, and that chemical traverses, diffuses across that space between two neurons, and then excites the postsynaptic cell, the cell on the other side. But the fusion of those vesicles occurs through a molecule called synapsin, and requires synapsin and requires another molecule called synaptotagmin. There's 20-some-odd synaptotagmins. One of them is used for most forms of synaptic transmission. What are the other 19 for? Why do we have 19 other synaptotagmin genes? And so it may be that there are different modes of synaptic transmission that take advantage of some of these different molecular pathways, and we don't yet know what all these different modes of transmission would be. So I suspect that we'll be able to figure some of this out as we have a better idea of what genes are expressed where and under what conditions.
It just occurred to me as a speech pathologist, I'm interested in word recall and disorders of word recall, and so that's more an issue of accessing memories. Like, is there any new research on that? Like, what is it that allows us to access things? Like, I, for some reason, have a two-minute delay for people's names half the time. I will try, and when I stop trying, the name will pop up all of a sudden, you know? I'm just wondering if they've learned anything about that.
You know, I think that's absolutely fascinating. I can't tell you a lot about language, although language is, it's a very particular and vibrant subfield in neuroscience. I can tell you, though, that when Wilder Penfield was surveying the cerebral cortex and looking for mapping the location of different response properties, he never found a site where he could stimulate and elicit a specific word. Never. And of course, though, we know based upon stroke studies that you can have a small lesion in the brain and lose your ability to generate language. But when he was microstimulating, even in some of the areas that we know are involved in language, he did not generate a spoken utterance of a specific word. And so it may be that language and the processes that encode language or enable us to generate language are not in the cerebral cortex. They're complex motor commands that involve a different brain structure, the basal ganglia. And there's some really interesting work that has come out of a specific gene mutation isolated from a family. Actually, it was a family in Great Britain. And there was a speech clinic there where they had a number of patients, a number of kids coming in, and I think there were like five kids from the same family, like two cousins and three sibs, and all of them had this aphasia. They couldn't generate language. Their comprehension was okay, but they couldn't generate words of more than one or two syllables, so like maybe mama or cup, but they couldn't sort of rapidly sequence sounds. And it turned out they all had a mutation in a specific gene that itself was responsible for controlling other genes. It was a transcription factor named FOXP2. And FOXP2 seems to be important for learning in a particular part of the brain called the striatum. And it has a very specific sequence in humans that you don't find, for example, in great apes. Interestingly enough, FOXP2 seems to be really critical in birdsong, and so many scientists who study plasticity in vocal learning are studying it in birdsong, not in people. My guess is that this is a different, because it wasn't in the cortex, it wasn't available, there haven't been microstimulation studies where you can induce speech formation, that it's probably in a different part of the brain, and it's probably in a motor sequencing part of the brain, which is typically what the basal ganglia are. I don't know if that's too technical, and I'm also sort of guessing a little bit here because it's the absence of evidence that I have, right, that I don't think that words are necessarily encoded in the hippocampus or in the cerebral cortex. But the concepts themselves might be. Sorry, I hope that addressed your question in some way. It's pretty good. FOXP2. Yeah.
Hi. I was wondering, you talked about evacuating memories and replacing the memories with the shocking of the mice and putting them back into their cages. And when I'm a psychology major, I have a bachelor's in psychology, and we studied the brain and fear memories, we talked about flooding. And I don't know if you've ever studied that with mice and had any done any research about flooding, and because it seems similar to what you were talking about.
No, what's flooding?
Flooding is when you say a person's afraid of something like snakes, and what you would do is it's a incremental exposure of the person to a snake. So first you would show them a snake, but they wouldn't be in the room with it, and then they progressively bring the snake in, and then make them touch it, and then make them hold it, and then something like that. I don't know if you ever studied anything like that with fear memories.
So that's sort of like extinguishing, right?
Right.
Extinguishing some fear memory. And so I think it's you're using the same sort of general principles, right? You're suppressing, and who knows what the original, it's probably pretty reasonable to be afraid of snakes.
Right.
But you're suppressing that by exposure therapy, by re-exposing in a non-threatening situation. The problem is that, you know, the minute that a snake or a bat or a bug does something, then that memory is still there. It's just been suppressed.
Right.
So.
I just had a quick second question. I was wondering, have you ever done any studies on amnesia at all?
Well, so me personally, right, the behavioral readout for the kind of sensory plasticity that we study is sort of, it's a perceptual sensitivity. The animals are now more sensitive to a stimulus. It's a very unsophisticated form of learning. We know that experience is changing the brain, but we don't know what the animal, it's not associative, okay? Amnesia is really interesting. You know, what it suggests, and so the questions that I raised at the end, like the things that we don't know, are this transfer between short-term and long-term memory. And, you know, I would say the field right now, there's sort of this mystical idea that sort of initially encoded in the hippocampus in some short-term way, and then it gets transferred to the cerebral cortex. But we really don't know how that occurs. And if you interrupt that process, then you may have amnesia, right? And so there are different kinds of amnesia, and that amnesia will extend different durations, right? Sometimes you'll have amnesia for things that happened a few days ago or a few weeks ago, but not a few years ago. And it suggests that this transfer process from short-term memory to long-term memory may occur in stages, and that you might be able to interfere with those different stages to yield those different results. Yeah, but I mean, as a biologist, I would say there must be a biochemical mechanism that you could get a wedge in there at one stage of memory versus another stage of memory. Right. And so it can be an incredibly useful tool.
Hi. My son has autism. He's very high on the spectrum, but he's extremely good at math, and I don't think it's like a short-term or long-term memory issue, but with patterns like behavior he has a difficult time. So, for instance, if I say, get up, it, you know, you have school today, time to get up, he'll get up, but he won't be able to remember that he needs to put on his clothes for school. If a teacher says, or the bell rings and it's time to go from the class, he can't remember to, like, put his stuff in his backpack. He just will go. Is there anything to help besides we have a lot of Post-it notes?
You know, it's interesting because there are a number of studies that suggest that people with autism actually might have a sort of a hypersensitivity, hyperperceptual sensitivity in very sort of discrete areas. So, for example, one of the studies that I find most fascinating is a study of visual acuity in autistic people where their visual acuity, you know, like normal vision might be 20/20. And there is just something like 20/12 or something, 28. I don't know. What I can see at 8 feet, they can see at 20 feet. And if you look at neurons from the brains of autistic, let's say, mice, okay, there are some genes that we know cause autism in humans. Those genes have been mutated in mice. And if we look at neurons from those mice, and I believe there have been some histological specimens from people as well, you can see that the structure, the anatomical structure of these neurons looks different. So, for example, there seem to be more connections in these neurons from the autistic mouse or the autistic individual. And so alongside of that, it seems that connectivity between areas may be suppressed. And so you have sort of hyper-functioning individual systems, but then the integration of those systems seems to be perhaps not less than normal. I don't know what to say. I don't know what hippocampal function, how it's been demonstrated in autistic individuals, and I don't know, you know, given the wide range of different types of autism, I think that there's probably a similar wide range in terms of memory disorders. You know, because there are different types of memory, right, there's explicit memory, right, where you can say, yes, I read this book, I recommend, you know, Remains of the Day by Kazuo Ishiguro, right? You know that name of everything, you can remember that. There's also implicit memory or procedural memory. And these are really different things. You can have total deficit in one, and you can be perfectly normal in another. So we go back to HM, this guy who had his hippocampus removed. The seizures stopped, but he could no longer transfer short-term memory into long-term memory. He could, however, learn how to do new sort of procedures. And one of the tasks that he was trained to do was a task called mirror writing. And so here's the task. You have a mirror. You can only watch the mirror. And you need to draw a star, okay? But you're watching the mirror. So when you think you're drawing the star, you're actually moving your hand in the other direction that you see in the mirror. So it's really hard, but you get better at it. And HM was trained on this task. And every day when he did this task, he would get a little bit better. And every day when he did this task, he would say, oh, I've never done that before, but he would get better. And it appeared that you're really using different brain structures for these different types of learning, right? So we were just talking about FOXP2, a transcription factor that seems to be important for speech, for learning to make motor movements, for rapidly sequencing motor movements that we would use in speech. And it seems to be expressed in a particular part of the brain that's important for procedural learning. And it might be that some forms of learning are not impaired, and you might be able to leverage those procedural that procedural learning from something that's more explicit, like, oh, my book report is due on Tuesday. And the way to do that is typically to do the same thing over and over and over again, so that, and maybe it has to be precise, so that every morning you have exactly the same routine, that there's no novelty, no deviation. You know, I'm not a clinician, And I can't imagine the struggles of working with your son. But given that there may be different sorts of memory that are encoded in different places in the brain, it may be that you can find a way to work around some more impaired and less impaired.
Post-it notes work okay. I have a second question. A friend of mine wasn't able to come tonight, but she wanted to. Will she be able to hear you?
I think there's a podcast. I think they were taping me.
Okay.
So, yeah.
All right. Thank you.
Sure.
Hi. I'm wondering if this rings a bell with you. 2 or 3 days ago, I think it was generated by CMU, Science Magazine or Kurzweil's website sent out a tweet where you open it up, somebody visualized in a 3D representation a synaptic connection with only 300,000 molecules in it. Were you guys connected with that?
I don't know if it was generated at Carnegie Mellon, but I did see it, and it was awesome.
Wasn't that phenomenal?
It was totally awesome. If you want me to send it out, I'm happy to send the post
somewhere.
I'll tweet
that.
It. You can
probably
sign
for the
up
first
for my
time
account.
In history, you could see.
Yeah, it was pretty amazing.
And, yeah, rotated around down to the molecular level, and you mentioned how in the synaptic connection, the chemicals go back and forth, and from what you're saying tonight, I was wondering because it's sort of like a cap in the ball, and the chemicals go back and forth, and the neurotransmitters and so forth. When you mentioned that a certain kind of experience, like, say, the Jennifer Aniston photograph, the first time this person saw it, and it strengthens the connection, does that mean that the cap in the ball actually gets bigger, or is the flow, the neurotransmitter, speeded up, or how is it strengthened?
That's a great question, and I feel much more equipped to answer these sort of really basic mechanistic questions than especially sort of the questions about therapy, which I feel sort of woefully inadequate to address. But, you know, we've been looking at this, and the field's been looking at this. It looks like they do get bigger. And so bigger synapses sort of function more robustly. So you actually are adding, you know, you're adding proteins to these synapses, these connections. And the reason that the electrical response gets bigger is because the anatomy gets bigger, too. So, and you know, it's pretty amazing. You can then track proteins as they're moving in and out of these connections. And those are an indicator of learning. They become a substitute for what we understand in terms of learning.
And you could see how it happens where the signal would get stronger as the anatomy of the thing blows up. And I guess it's like a muscle almost. It gets bigger and stronger. And the more you feed it with the right neurotransmitters and so forth, although you did say there's really not much one could do to feed their head, so to speak, and maximize these chemicals of acetylcholine that we know of right now, I guess.
I mean, one problem is figuring out where to look because, you know, like we've been focused on identifying the right cells. But, I mean, you know, if there's 100 billion cells, there's an awful lot of synapses. There's 10,000 times that number of synapses. And so if you want to see a synapse get bigger or smaller, you've got to have some pretty good guesses to start with. But you
can't really load your personal entity up with maximized chemicals in your blood system that are legal and over the counter that would maximize.
No, it doesn't work that way. No, it doesn't work that way, unfortunately. Yeah, too bad.
Well, so far, I agree with so very much of what you've been saying. Repetition does reinforce learning and that kind of thing. I do have a question that's embedded into eidetic imagery or photographic.
Sorry, can you speak in the mic because I just have trouble. Pull the mic down maybe. Oh yeah, perfect.
Is that better?
Yeah.
Oh, right. I do have a question in terms of wanting to know how you feel about eidetic imagery or photographic memory, as well as the types of stimuli that reinforce learning. You know, until I got to grad school, I never hardly had to take a note as long as I could hear if I was in the room. Even now, if someone wants to give me directions somewhere, I'd have to have them tell me. But if you wrote a map, I couldn't get it. So that's a specific type of stimuli. Is that correct?
I mean, I think that's a fascinating observation, right? This comes back to one of the other questions that was asked. Why are there different types of learners? You know, there's some stimuli that make a huge impression on, you know, some people have to watch it, some people have to read it. I feel like I'm particularly bad about learning how to do something by reading directions. It's terrible. But if you show me, I can get it. And again, it suggests to me that there may be different mechanisms in different parts of the brain. You asked about photographic memory, and I think that's very interesting. From a cellular and molecular perspective, people have been really interested in what's required to transfer some experience from a short-term memory to a long-term memory. Or, you know, and you may be encoding all of the things that are happening to you right now, right? But only some of it will be then transferred into some, you know, memory that you can recall in a few weeks' time. And so people have been really interested in what do you need to do to a cell in order to strengthen the connections between that cell? What's the minimum you need to do to a cell in order to make those synapses stronger? So now we're not talking about photographic memory, right? Can you remember what kind of shoes the person next to you is wearing? But now we're talking about what's the minimum that one cell needs to do to another cell in order to fundamentally alter that connection. And it looks like one of the critical things that has to happen is you have to transcribe new genes. You have to kick the nucleus, kick the genetic machinery of that cell, turn it on, and that is what you need in order to start encoding things sufficiently. And so you can, in fact, manipulate this by making it easier for new genes to be transcribed, and you all of a sudden then can get animals where you can train them to do something instead of in 10 presentations, they can do it in one. So we do understand something about this. It seems to have something to do with gene transcription. We can manipulate it a little bit. It's been easier to do in fruit flies than in mice, and of course we haven't done anything like this in people, but it does give us the idea that we need to look at how genes are turned on, and that the clue to changing the threshold or improving memory might lie in controlling gene transcription.
I think I get it.
In the first place, I'd like to say thank you for tonight's lecture. In the second, you've talked about memories being written down, but it also sounds like when you recall memories, you can rewrite them. The reason why I'm asking this was once I had to testify in court, and one of the things I had to do was I was asked by the DA to describe a knife. And I started to describe the knife, and I had a particular image of a particular knife in my head. The DA presented me with the knife and asked me, "Is this the knife?" And I realized two things at the same time. One, that was in fact the knife that was involved. And two, it was not the knife I was about to describe. I had overwritten, somehow I had overwritten the memory of the knife. Mm-hmm. But I was also capable of recognizing the knife when presented with it. I'm thinking back to Penfield's stimulation. How is this rewriting essentially worked out?
Let's differentiate between recall and recollection, right? Recognition, thank you. Recognition and recall, right? And so recognition is a lot easier than recall. Recall, you actually have to dig up the details of that, you know, the specific attributes of that stimulus or that object. And recognition is really just matching them to some template. So that's a much, much easier question, right? And so I think one thing that might happen is that you sometimes use categories as a way to sort of shorthand for memory, right? That it was, you know, it was some shoes like those shoes. You know, you sort of have a rough idea of some of the right kinds of things. They weren't sandals, they were shoes. They weren't pink, they were probably brown. And so that becomes a shorthand for the actual attributes of the stimulus. But the interesting thing is that you can actually recognize something and then correct all those categorical sort of generalizations. So that's a fascinating anecdote, actually. I don't know where that was happening, but it's really interesting.
Okay, thank you.
Any more questions? All right. Thank you, Dr. Barr.